get yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, this is our first show here after the holiday break, in which we ran a couple of previous shows. So let's pick up where the global economy is. Boy, there's some interesting news, isn't there? Yes, let's talk about China. Oh, yes. In the news this week. But I also want to talk about what's going on with South America and the ugly head of neoliberalism rising once again throughout that continent, and a big attack going on in the three main economies that have tried to establish some independence from the United States: Venezuela, Brazil, and Argentina. That's not so much in the news, but it's extremely important. We're going to see a lot of turmoil down there in South America this year, and it has to do with the destabilization of those economies, which is really being led not just by the United States, but by central banks and others in the advanced economies, you might call them, of Europe, U.S., and Japan. Okay, we're going to talk about South America as part of our roundtable here at the beginning of our show, of looking at what's going on this past week. But I also want to start here with China. China, the news on China. Well, we're right in the middle of that one, aren't we? This past Monday, this earlier in this past week, what happened was the China stock market began to collapse again. All right, we want to know why that happened. And in China, they have what they call circuit breakers. Well, we have them here in the U.S. too, for stock market declines when they're too rapid and too deep. And the circuit breaker kicked in. There's two circuit breakers here that China uses. One is if the stock market total aggregate values drop more than 5%, they shut down the market, buying and selling, for a couple hours. But then they opened it up. And if it then falls to 7%, they shut it down for the day. All right? That's to prevent a panic selling, so forth, going on. Well, the circuit breakers earlier this week kicked in. All of a sudden, on Monday and Tuesday, you know, we had this big drop in stock equity prices on the big markets there, stock equity markets in China. Then they opened it up, and there was a little bumping along the bottom. And then yesterday, Thursday, we had another big event where 7% decline in the values. And they shut down again. Well, okay, today there's a little modest recovery here going on. Very modest. You know, whenever there is big declines, you get bottom feeders jump in, and they think it's just temporary, and the stock stabilizes. You know, stock markets go down in a ratchet-like effect. So do economies. And so we got this big question here. What's going to happen next week with China markets? And, of course, it's extremely obvious that this big correction going on in China, in their markets, is having a similar effect, you know, a knock-on effect, if you would, on the stock market here in the United States, which dropped almost 400 points yesterday and a couple hundred previously in the week. You know, it's like 900 points down, the Dow, at least, and Dow Jones market in the U.S., and the other major markets have been proportionally down as well, the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ in the U.S. and in Europe as well. Okay, we're seeing similar big drops in Europe. So there's this reverberation going on from China, from this financial instability in the financial markets in China. We need to understand that a little bit. I'll talk a little bit about that. And we need to understand, well, what precipitated this latest downturn in China in the markets? You know, we had this big event over the summer where the same thing happened, and we had like a 45% correction in China, in the stock markets, and the Chinese government stepped in with a series of draconian measures to stop the selling and increase the buying. And I won't go over all those measures. I think we had a show back in August on that. But, you know, basically they prohibited the sales of stocks, froze them in a number of ways. And then they got other government agencies in China to start buying stocks. You know, if you buy, the demand goes up and drives up the price, you know, the aggregate value of the stock market. If you sell, if there's panic selling, then the price collapses, the stock market collapses. So the idea is you've got to stop the selling and increase the buying if you want to stabilize the market. Okay, so China did that and spent like $300-400 billion getting state-owned enterprises and other quasi-public and public agencies in China to stimulate the buying while it put a freeze pretty much in various ways on the selling. And what happened after that, you know, it sort of stabilized a little bit. The market had risen in just 1 year, 120%. What a bubble. Yes, well, that's another explanation why it rose 120%. By the way, let me digress briefly. If you want to understand the deeper history of what's happened in China here, particularly since 2007, my book has a chapter, my just published book, January 1st, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy, has a chapter on China called Bubbles, Bubbles, Debt and Troubles, Chapter 6. So take a look at that if you're particularly interested in China. And there's other chapters on what's going on in Europe, you know, Europe's chronic stagnation, and then on Japan, chapter on Japan, its perpetual recession, and emerging markets as well. The perfect storm emerging in emerging markets. And then a theoretical analysis of why this is all going on and why mainstream economics just doesn't understand it and can't predict it, therefore. Okay, so enough for the plug of the book. You can buy it on Amazon. You can also go to my website, which is www.kyklosproductions, kyklosproductions.com. You can buy it through PayPal there. Or you can go to the publisher as well, Clarity Press. Okay, back to China. Back to China, per se. All right. What happened this week that all of a sudden the bottom fell out again of the stock market? Well, these emergency, draconian emergency measures imposed by the government in China in July, August, sort of froze up the decline. It had to decline further, you know. The markets ballooned 120%. They rose 120% in less than a year in China. And they corrected about 45% here over the summer and then recovered a little bit of that. So it's like they bottled up the inevitable collapse of that market. It's just too far overvalued, and even after they temporarily stabilized it in July, August, still way overvalued. So now we started a second downward leg on all that decline in the market. And really what's behind the decline is the realization that the real economy in China is slowing rapidly. You know, it's not the 6.97% figures in GDP terms that China is reporting. That economy is not growing more than 4 or 5%, a few, which is not insignificant, but that compares to 12, 14% 4 or 5 years ago. And since 2012, 13 in particular, it's been slowing progressively faster than is being reported. Well, you know, if you're an investor, you're not going to invest in a company that is declining or at risk of bankruptcy, which a lot of the enterprises are in China right now. There's $2.5 trillion, not yuan, dollars of non-performing loans in China. $2.5 trillion. In other words, non-performing means they're not paying principal or interest. you know, a lot of good part of the economy, particularly traditional enterprises, are pretty much zombie enterprises over there. Not just China, you know, this is a global problem phenomenon. In the wake of the 2008-09 crash here, we've got probably $1.5 trillion in non-performing bank loans in Europe, $2.5 trillion here in China, undoubtedly maybe a trillion more if you conservatively, if you add up Japan and the U.S. and who knows how much more in emerging markets now that they're, you know, in a free fall. So we're looking at $5 to $10 trillion in non-performing bank loans everywhere, you know, and that's after all these central banks, you know, in the U.S., the Federal Reserve, the European Central Bank, Bank of Japan, England, so forth, you know, have pumped, I estimate, about $25 trillion of liquidity money into the global economy with their QEs and their zero interest rates since 2009. At least $25 trillion. All right, $9-10 trillion in QE alone, and the rest of zero interest rates and other measures, a massive amount of money injection. And a lot of that flowed into emerging markets and into China initially after 2009 and caused, you know, a big spike in their growth and their financial markets at the expense of the advanced economies, where we had this very sluggish growth and double-dip recessions and triple-dip recessions in Japan and Europe, four of the last five winters in the United States, GDP has collapsed near zero, single quarter GDP, and we pump it up to avoid a double-dip here. Actually, we probably had at least one double-dip. We redefined GDP and to help prevent the realization of double-dips as well here in the U.S. Anyway, $25 trillion pumped into the economy, global economy, and we have $5 to $10 trillion in non-performing bank loans. In other words, the banks aren't lending to those who are in trouble and who need it most. They are lending to financial speculators. They are lending to these places where there's some growth, multinational corporations who really don't need the money, many of them. They're partly shadow banks themselves. And it's not getting to the companies that have been in, you know, really need it and to invest in real growth and so forth. And that's a big problem in the global economy right now. All these non-performing loans out there and all the debt that's continued to rise since 2009. There hasn't been any real correction of all this debt. In fact, according to the Bank of International Settlements, there's been an increase globally of debt of $25 to $50 trillion in debt. Oh, that's just about the amount that the central banks have pumped into the economy. A lot of it has gone into emerging markets, by the way. That's where the big debt increases occurred, and it's not really the governments. There's been increased government debt in advanced economies, but in emerging market economies, Latin America, Asia, and Africa, and China, you know, it's private sector debt. Businesses borrowing for real investment and for speculating. All right, $25-40 trillion. $40 trillion, according just to the Bank of International Settlements in Geneva at the end of 2013. So you know it's about $50 trillion today. $50 trillion of additional debt added on top of the crisis, which was in large part due to too much debt as well, since 2009, 2010. Okay, that's the big global picture here. A lot of this debt, by the way, this debt has gone into China to finance their boom in 2010 to 2012, right? And China increased its liquidity through its central bank and other means as well. Massive increase in liquidity in China that helped fuel its boom. Now is coming home to roost. Just to give you some idea of how much liquidity in China was pumped in since 2008, the typical M2 money supply increased, in dollar terms. Let's see, I'm looking at my figures here. Just in the first 2 years, 2010-2012, doubled from $6.5 trillion to $13 trillion. Okay, just in the first 2 years. Well, this is money flowing in from the West and through shadow banking conduits and so forth into China. Right? And that's just the first 2 years. Right? Liquidity tripled to about $22 trillion by 2015, from $6.5 trillion to $22 trillion, more than twice the growth rate and volume of China's GDP growth, which was significant. In other words, about half of this huge flow of liquidity into China went into expanding China and emerging markets in those first 2 years, but a lot of it went into speculation as well. Right? And ever since 2012, you know, we have a decline in, slowdown rather, in real investment in China and elsewhere. Right? McKinsey & Company, big global business research consulting firm, estimated that China's total debt, government and private consumer, rose from $7.5 trillion in 2007 to $28 trillion as of mid-2014. That's a year and a half ago. Right? And it represents 282% of China's GDP. China is the most indebted country, you know, even worse than Greece, in the world today, right? Massive debt overhang going on. $28 trillion in outstanding debt in China as of mid-2014, right? Mostly held by non-financial businesses, right? 18 of that $28 trillion, roughly two-thirds, as of 2014, is business financial debt. Business financial debt, most of which is corporate debt. Okay, so this idea that government debt is the big problem, yes, it is a problem, but this private sector debt is really the big problem. The Bank of International Settlements data, also for ending 2013, showed that the $40 trillion in global debt increase that occurred since 2007, $25 trillion of that is in emerging markets. Okay? $18 trillion of that, as we've seen in China, so another $7 trillion, you know, in Brazil and so on and so forth, right? And that's only as of it's $50 trillion now, at least I would say. we don't have the latest figures yet; no one's published them, right? Well, you can't have all that money plowing into China, even though it's financing real investment to some extent that it did for a couple of years, without creating financial bubbles. And that's what happened in China. The first big bubble, of course, was in local housing. A lot of this money flowed into local government financial vehicles, as they're called, LGFVs, and that caused the housing construction bubble. Okay, well, China tried to dampen that bubble, China government, to some extent, but the money just flowed out of that bubble and into another bubble, which is asset management products. And then China had the idea, China policymakers, that, oh, look, you know, why don't we redirect that into the stock market? Because rising stock values will provide an incentive for private businesses in China to reinvest and expand and create jobs and get the real economy going. Because you see, in the first phase following the 2008-09 crash, China engaged in a massive government investment project, 15% of GDP, in order to get the economy going, which was successful. You know, government investment was like 45-50% of total GDP. In the U.S., you know, government spending is about 20%. So, and that's not all real investment. This was a lot of direct investment in China. So that's how China got out of the crash quicker than others. The U.S. spent maybe 4% of its GDP on its stimulus program and then took it away in 2011 with deficit cuts again. But China, you know, about 15% of its GDP went into a real investment, but directed by the government. So China, you know, thought that part of this, let's get away from relying on just government investment and let's have private investment and private consumption. They call this, you know, the transition to a normal economy is what they call this in the West, you know, that's driven by private investment and private consumption instead of just government investment. China has bought into that, and China is trying to make that transition. Well, this is where this redirecting all this excess money, capital, and credit that's floating around in the housing industry in China, redirected into the stock market in China. That was a policy that was adopted in late 2013, early 2014, as China government put a damper on the excess housing and construction. They moved it, tried to move the money into investment in private investment in general to stop the bubble, which they did in the housing, but they create bubbles elsewhere as the money flowed around elsewhere and went into the stock markets in China with incentives by the government. The government wanted the money to flow in the stock market. It allowed excess margin buying of stocks and caused all kind of speculators to arise and shadow banks to arise in China. There's over 4,000 shadow banks, hedge fund-like companies in China, and that money flowed into the stock market in 2013, mid-2013, and by mid-2014, we had a crisis there, and that crisis was, the bubble burst because of all the incentives to invest in the stock market. It drove it up 120% much too fast, right? So it came down real fast. And, this collapse of the China market coincides with the collapse of the global oil prices. They are linked together, right? So we have this collapse that really, really hit here in the summer, last summer, in June. That brings us up to where we left off in China here in terms of trying to stop that collapse in the stocks here this past summer through these draconian measures, which succeeded to some extent. They succeeded. Temporarily. Following July-August events, what happened was that China got the green light from the IMF to include its currency, the yuan, renminbi, whatever you want to call it, as part of a global trading currency. Once it did that, China's currency had to decline because its economy is slowing and declining. It had to decline. But it had a hard time because it's pegged to the dollar. You see, the Chinese currency has been pegged to the dollar for years now. So, how can you devalue it if it's pegged to the dollar? Well, once you agree to have it as a global currency, it's inevitable. It has to decline. And over the last 5 years, having been pegged to the dollar, what we see is China's currency has appreciated, risen by 35% at least against the Japanese yen and other currencies. And as China's economy is now slowing, and their exports are slowing, because they're not competitive, the pressure is on to devalue the currency further to make up this 35% loss, particularly against the Japanese. You see, you hear the government, U.S. government, complain about China's currency. Well, the big currency manipulator is Japan, and to some extent Europe, and the U.S. says nothing about them because that's part of its economic satrapies, its empire, economic empire, the U.S., you see, Japan especially. But you got to remember, it's still pegged to the dollar. But what happened in July, August was China allowed it to devalue as far as it could given that peg. There's like a band that its currency can fluctuate against the dollar. But once you agree to the IMF and it's a global currency, it's got to fluctuate more than that band. Right. So what's been happening since August is that we have what's called the offshore currency for the yuan, the Chinese currency, and that's been devaluing, been declining as the real economy in China slows, and putting pressure on the official currency value, pegged still within a band to the dollar, to decline as well. Right. And what happened this past week is that it was decided by investors that it's inevitable that the currency is going to have to devalue even further, right? And if the currency is devaluing, the value of your investments are going to decline. So those investors who have pumped the money into the stock market there want to get out. They want to sell those currencies and move out of Chinese currency, yen, into dollars and other currencies, especially since the U.S. is talking about raising rates, which will raise the dollar even more, you see. So we have a lot of capital flight since August, and particularly since June, which has been occurring, capital flight from China. Money's moving out of China, right, and out of emerging markets in general. But the indications are that the real economy is suffering even more in China, declining even more. That means the stock values will decline even more, and therefore they want to get out even more. You know, real investment in China is down 50% since 2012. Industrial production also down 50%. And the economy is not making this transition to consumption. Consumption retail sales have been flat. You know, it's not making it up. All this talk about making a transition, yeah, I think is really debatable. Can China make the transition? I'm not so sure it can. If it can't, then its economy is going to continue to slow, which it is, and its pressure on its currency will continue to decline, right? The currency has declined about 5% in August, right? And now you got experts saying that, it's inevitable now that it's a global currency per the IMF that it will have to decline 20%. 20%. Well, that's probably correct because, it has to adjust 20% to the 50% increase in relationship to the Japanese yen and other currencies around there. But this is the problem. If the currency declines, if the yuan declines further, it intensifies this global currency war going on. You see, everybody, as the global economy slows, which is happening significantly here, the export pie that everyone's competing for gets smaller and smaller. So you get Europe trying to devalue its currency, right, in order to get a competitive price advantage to steal some exports from China. And Japan engages in a QE that devalues their currency to try to do the same in response to Europe. Emerging markets are doing all they can similarly. And, of course, the pressure's on China to do the same if it wants to grow, especially if the stock market is collapsing and prices are falling. You know, if the prices are falling, you don't want to invest in the company, do you? You don't want to buy their stock, and the company is in trouble. Real investment stops, and if the stock market collapses, it has a negative effect on consumption as well. So there is a kind of a feedback effect going between China stocks and China currencies, and it's exacerbating in a negative way both, one first, then the other. But behind it is the real economy slowing down dramatically. Right. What we're going to see once this devaluation pressure breaks through, which is going to happen here, in other words, there's inevitably going to be further decline in China stock values, and that's going to have a further effect on other financial markets elsewhere. The circuit breakers that they actually implemented this week on Monday and Thursday, 7% decline, so we've got, like a 14% decline minimum in China stocks just in 1 week, right? That can't but spill over to other stock markets. We already see it happen to the U.S. stock market, don't we? Next week, I think there's a significant probability that we're going to see some major stock market corrections going on next week in the U.S. as well as elsewhere. I may be wrong, but quite possibly, investors, speculators are itching to take their money and run. And that means selling stock. That means declining stock values. Right. China has already spent about $500 billion in the last 6 months trying to prop up its currency and prop up the its stock market. $500 billion. You know, you hear a commentator say, oh, China's got all these reserves and so forth, and they can handle it. Yes, they have massive reserves, but they aren't unlimited reserves. You see, they're not unlimited. And at some point, you know, not tomorrow, but at some point, the China government is going to try to conserve its reserves. And it's going to stop supporting its currency. It's going to let it decline, and it's going to stop supporting the market, the stock market, and it's going to let it decline. And then it's anybody's guess what happens in terms of global financial instability. At a time when we see financial instability growing everywhere, in the U.S., of course, the collapsing oil prices globally is causing more instability, particularly in other financial markets like the junk bond market in the U.S. And if we get a big correction here in the market, stocks, we're going to see exchange-traded funds become a problem, liquidity availability and bonds. There's a lot of financial fragility out there, meaning the financial side of the economy can become very unstable very quickly, right? I mean, given this instability in the financial markets and the global oil price collapse now that's following the markets and both the markets and global oil, and oil, of course, is a financial asset. We're talking about future contracts, futures trading contracts, and oil. Oil is not just a pure commodity. It's a financial asset. We see the price now of global oil down in the low 30s. There's a parallel crisis in deflating prices of commodities and oil going on as we have all this financial volatility in stocks and bonds beginning to erupt. So, you know, contagion effects from what's happened in China. Well, first of all, other stock markets, the U.S. and others, we see that happening, and next week probably could happen even more. We see other currencies already responding in anticipation to a further decline in the yuan, right? Lower oil prices, which are following in parallel, you know, with these market values, and causing them in turn and being caused by them, right? U.S., Russia, Venezuela, Nigeria, you know, all of them are being significantly impacted in terms of government revenues. Capital expenditures globally are slowing everywhere, right? We have possibility of junk bond defaults arising, especially in emerging markets. You know, there's $25-40 trillion of private corporate debt that has been built up in emerging markets is the number one firestorm potential in the global economy, I think. You know, because all that debt that was built up over the last 5-6 years, how are they going to pay for it? You know, with their exports slowing now, with the global economy slowing, these countries don't have the income to continue servicing that debt. Well, when you can't service your debt, you go bankrupt. You know, when you go bankrupt, then companies collapse, and banks that loan the money collapse, and workers lose their jobs, and so forth, and you've got a general crisis going on. I think we're looking into the mirror of a general crisis in emerging markets coming. Because emerging markets, like in Latin America and places in Asia, are getting whipsawed by both the decline in stock values and rising rates in the U.S. and competitive devaluations in Europe, Japan, and soon China, right? All this results in massive capital flight from emerging markets. And in order to try to slow down the money leaving the emerging markets, those countries, you know, Brazil and others, they raise their interest rates to try to keep the money there. And that just throws the domestic economy into a deep recession like we're seeing in Brazil, right? The collapse of global commodities and oil in particular, and the capital flight and the currency decline, you know, in countries like Venezuela, Brazil, and Argentina, You know, all that results in the money flowing out of those countries, and then these responses by these governments to try to keep the money there, which just collapses their economy even further. So other commodity price collapses are inevitable if we see these equity collapses going on, and those in turn will exacerbate the equity collapses. They feed off of each other, right? Other countries that are at risk are Korea, Japan, Australia, that are very central to China's exports. Now, there's a lot of semi-manufactured goods are made by Japanese and Korean companies, both in their own countries and in China. They're sent to China, they're assembled in China, and exported from China. Australia, very dependent on the sale of natural resources to China, you know, iron, coal, and so on and so forth. All these countries are behind the eight ball as China's real economy slows, and now its financial side of its economy becomes increasingly unstable. Right. And U.S. manufacturing and German manufacturing are now feeling the pressure as well. U.S. manufacturing is slowing the last couple of months. Clearly, it's in negative territory. Germany is the same, and industrial production in Germany. Germany sells one-third of all its exports to China. Well, as China's economy slows, then the demand for German exports slows as well. So China is the focal point right now of the global instability and crisis, and other emerging markets behind the scene are gyrating and having a difficult time as well, which leads us to the second thing I want to talk about today, which is what's going on in South America, in those three major economies in South America: Venezuela, Brazil, and Argentina. Well, what's going on there is that deep crisis going on. It's beginning to take a political reflection as well. Let's step back a little bit and talk about U.S. policy towards South America. You know, we hear about this pivot to Asia in the U.S. Well, quietly, the U.S. is pivoting to South America again. While the U.S. was distracted in the Middle East, and still is to some extent, since 9/11, it's allowed some of those countries in South America to go out on a more independent direction, right? And they have, and we've had quasi-progressive social democratic type economies and regimes there, particularly in Venezuela, Brazil, and Argentina until recently. In that interstice there, they were able to develop their economies. And they were aided by all that capital flow that occurred that I just talked about out of the AEs after 2009 into the emerging markets, right? It helped China boom, and China demand for commodities and semi-finished goods from those economies and loaning money to those economies helped boom those economies in South America and elsewhere in the world as well. So they all enjoyed from 2010-2012, you know, this boom phase. But the boom phase flattened out in 12-13 and now is in declining ever since. Well, you know, we have this problem of the economies in Latin America, as I described, especially as part, you know, part of this emerging market problem where you have all this capital flight and you have the major advanced economies engaging in this competitive devaluations, which drives the emerging market economy, South American economy, currencies down even further. You get currency collapse. Well, if you get currency collapse, investors start pulling their money out and sending it back to the U.S., especially if the U.S. is raising interest rates. So it's like a double, triple whammy on these economies in South America. This is a period of dislocation that the U.S. is now turning to and trying to take advantage of. We see it especially in the case of Venezuela. You know, the U.S. has been preparing the groundwork in Venezuela by doing all it can to help disrupt that economy. you know, the economy, very dependent, Venezuelan economy, very dependent in any event on global oil prices. So when oil prices collapse from $120 to $35, you know, 90-some percent of all the government's revenue and spending, you know, comes from oil. So if you have, you know, trip cut it by 80%, 70-80%, you know, what are they going to do for their budgets? You know, what are they going to do? They just don't have the revenue. And those countries have to buy a lot of things from elsewhere in the world, and they got to use dollars to do it. You can't use bolivars, the Venezuelan currency, or, you know, Brazilian reals to buy that, because they're not global currencies. You know, they're already facing this collapse of their economies because of oil and other commodity price declines in those three countries. And, of course, that causes their currencies to decline, right, which means they have to spend more to buy imports that they need from other countries. So the currency is the key here. The currency collapse and capital flight as a result of the slowing economies is essential. Now, on top, overlaid on top of all this, the U.S. is clearly pivoting to South America again and doing all it can economically and politically behind the scenes to prop up these conservative right-wing business-dominated, in some cases reactionary, new regimes that are riding the economic crisis in South America and coming to power. We see this with the Macri government in Argentina that just took office, right? Pushing out the Kirchner, previous to Kirchner government, which was at least somewhat social democratic, providing some resources to other than business interests, and looking at Argentina's independent economic interests, not the U.S. and U.S. multinationals. We see it in Brazil, the economy in a shambles in Brazil, and the attempt to first take over the parliament and now try to push Dilma Rousseff, the elected president, out through talk of impeachment and so forth. And Venezuela, it's most obvious where the U.S. is doing all it can and has for the last couple of years to try to destabilize the economy. The destabilization begins, of course, because of this world oil and commodity collapse going on. But okay, so why do we have a world oil collapse? Well, that's because we got this fight going on between Saudi Arabia and U.S. oil frackers. You know, in 2014, Saudi Arabia saw the threat from U.S. oil, and U.S. would not be as dependent on it for oil, and it Saudi Arabia, lose control of global oil, crude oil price. So it started lowering the price of global oil in order to drive the U.S. frackers out of business. And that fight's been going on since mid-2014, and it has caused the decline of global oil to a great extent. The weak recovery, of course, global recovery has added to that, you know, lowering the demand for it, naturally as well. But Saudi Arabia trying to drive its competitors into bankruptcy here by lowering the price of oil has been the primary focus, okay? And now, of course, we've got others that have come online in terms of oil production, Iraq first, and now we've got Iran. You know, a lot of the conflict going on between Saudi Arabia and Iran now has to do with this question of oil, right? Iran is selling as much oil as it can at whatever price it can. So is Russia, because they need that revenue. They can't allow market share to be captured by the Saudis. And the Saudis, you know, don't want to lose their market share. So it's a fight over market share here. And they're all driving the price of oil down as the economy, global economy, slows in any event. And so adding fuel to the fire, in other words, the politics The regional capitalist who's going to control global oil price is adding fuel to the fire of an already declining, slowing global economy, driving down the price of oil. Okay, and that's true with other commodities as well as the global economy slows. And that's why emerging markets are in part why they're in such a dire shape here. And no country is perhaps more dire than Venezuela, depending on 95% of its revenue here in oil. So given that fact, its currency has been collapsing significantly. Now, the U.S. has stepped in and done everything it can to ensure that it collapses even further, right? And that's been the case here for some time. And just recently, the U.S. has endorsed the currency collapse by encouraging speculators operating out of Colombia and this website called Dollar Today to short the Bolivar, the Venezuelan currency, and depress it still further. U.S.-based media, including the arch-conservative Cato Institute, is fanning the flames by saying, oh, there's been a 700% decline in your currency, Venezuela. It's like a Radio Free America there targeting Venezuelans, to get them to dump their currency, to sell the bolivars through this Dollar Today website. And thus, if you're selling everything, it declines, and whatever you're buying rises, the dollar rises, right? Causes more currency collapse. Meanwhile, multinational corporations in Venezuela are hoarding more than $11 billion in dollars, which causes the dollar to rise even more and the bolivar to fall even more. And all of these developments are causing a shortage of dollars and a willingness for people to just, sell their bolivars, declining in value, and to grab the dollars. Well, it creates a shortage of goods. If the corporations are hoarding the dollars, then Venezuela doesn't have the currency it needs to buy foreign imports for medicine, food, and so on and so forth. So you get a black market. And the black market, is blamed on the government, and the currency decline is blamed on the government, and the collapse of oil revenues is blamed on the government. So it's easy for the right wing in the U.S. To point the finger at the Maduro government there in Venezuela and say, see what happens with socialism? See? But they're the ones who are destabilizing the whole thing. Destroying a currency is the number one way to destabilize a government. And the U.S. has taken advantage of global forces already declining the currency and is doing all it can with multinational corporations and setting up these sites and so forth to drive the currency down even more, create more of a black market and more of a dollar shortage, which means you can't import critical goods. It means businesses there can't import critical materials to continue production, which results in falling production, layoffs, plant closures, rising unemployment, and more economic unrest. So currency collapse, inflation, recession also result in more capital flight out of the country, which exacerbates everything. So we get a vicious cycle of general economic collapse. In parallel with this, the U.S. is raising the bar, saying, oh, corruption here in Venezuela, and is targeting Venezuelan state-owned oil company, Petróleos de Venezuela, with legal suits. The Obama government earlier this year, earlier in 2015, issued executive orders freezing assets of Venezuelan government and military representatives, charging them with human rights abuses, right? It then arrests recently Venezuelan businessmen in the United States, holding them without bail, sending a message to other business people in Venezuela, you better switch your support to the new right-wing government here, right? The U.S. indicts Venezuela government and military officials, recently charging them with alleged drug conspiracy, including National Guard generals who were supporting the Maduro government. Right? The whole idea of all these legal suits is to raise the impression that it's corruption in this government that is causing all this economic problem. Well, that's not the case. The economic problems are global oil and commodity collapse, capital flight, currency collapse, inability to get resources to keep the economy going as a result, and hoarding of dollars by those who have them down there, creating black markets as a result, and shortages, which then get blamed upon the government, because average folks don't understand the transmission here from one cause to the other effect, and cause a greater dislocation in Venezuela. At the same time, you know, in through the back door, money flows to these unofficial channels, to these opposition parties and politicians, enable them to capture the National Assembly in Venezuela, right? This is a case example of what goes on here and how to destabilize the country economically as part of the pivot. You know, the U.S. has already helped engineer the rise of the Macri government in Argentina. Macri immediately devalued the currency overnight, wiped out small business and worker savings as a result. Because when your currency collapses, you know, inflation rises, because in these countries they're more dependent on imports. So import prices automatically rise 20-30%, and that wipes out your real wage gains and so forth overnight. You know, what you struggled maybe to get a 20% raise over the last 5 years in these economies, it wipes out overnight by one dictate here by the new pro-business governments, pro-U.S. governments. It's working, I'm sure, behind the scenes to pull off the same thing in Brazil, which is a basket case now. Again, the U.S. and others raising these corruption claims here, usually with state-owned enterprises like the oil enterprises and so forth, because that's tied to the government. So if you attack them as corrupt, you're attacking the government as corrupt. And creating in the popular mind that, you know, it's just total mismanagement here. And that's why everything is wrong. Well, it's not so much mismanagement, it's the collapse of the global economy, commodities and oil for these countries on the one hand, and it's the U.S. pivoting towards South America to do whatever it can to exacerbate these conditions through the currency. You see, you wreck the currency and then you wreck the economy. Then you link that wreckage to corruption and the ruling government, you know, the social democratic progressive governments. And that way, then you finance the opposition. And the opposition takes over one or more institutions like they have in Venezuela, in Argentina, and they've taken over the assembly and now in Venezuela. And there'll be a big fight now between what's left of the base of the progressive Chavist government there. And in Brazil, the same thing. The Workers' Party, the Rousseff government, big fights coming in Latin America. A harbinger of things to come. And all of this is neoliberalism, you see. Neoliberalism is on the march again in South America. It was pushed back temporarily while the U.S. was preoccupied elsewhere in the Middle East, you know. But now the global crisis, renewing global crisis in emerging markets, has given the U.S. an opportunity to repivot back to South America and reestablish neoliberal policies and regimes that are more favorable to U.S. interests. It succeeded already in Argentina. Big fight still on the way in Brazil and in Venezuela. But if you're interested I recently wrote an article on this, neoliberalism raises its ugly head in South America. You can look at it at my blog, jackrasmus.com. This was published by Telesur, which is the South American media conglomerate there, financed basically by those progressive governments. As Washington targets Venezuela, Brazil, and Argentina is the subheader to that. But if you want to understand the basic form or strategy of economic destabilization by wrecking currencies, which is the formal model for U.S. destabilization of economies, take a look at that article. Neoliberalism raises its ugly head in South America. All right, that'll give you some sense. To sum up here to some extent, what we've got is this clear picture of growing instability economically in China and in South America in particular, and I don't want to leave out other Asian and other emerging markets, because a lot of them are in the same boat, different degrees, different places, right? But what we've got here with China and the stock market decline, behind which is the real economy decline, right? Putting pressure on the currency to decline in China, and market investors anticipating this and trying to get their money out and run, trying to sell everything in the markets, which causes the markets to collapse so much. So there's this connection between the real economy slowing faster than they're telling us in China, putting downward pressure on Chinese currency, and the belief of investors that this is going to break through this band and this range pegged to the dollar. It's inevitable now that China's currency is a part of a global currency approved by the IMF. So this devaluation is coming because the economy is declining. The yuan has to devalue. It's been way overvalued. China has allowed the Japanese and Europeans to steal its exports. With its economy slowing, it cannot afford to do that anymore. The currency will decline. So investors are trying to get their money out of the markets and run. That's what it's about. And China's trying to prevent that collapse occurring overnight with these circuit breakers, but they're not working anymore. And it's going to happen. The circuit breakers aren't going to break much anymore, and you're going to see a more rapid decline in the stock market and the Chinese currency as its real economy declines. And the contagion effects are already beginning to appear on other currencies, on other stock markets, on further decline in global oil prices and commodities, and the whole what's called the supply chain connections between Korea, Japan, and Australia, U.S. and German manufacturing, etc. China is not going to make the transition without a hard landing to private investment and private consumption. I don't even know if they're going to make it at all, that's what it looks like to me. And that's going to have major destabilizing effects on the global economy. China's like 20% of the global economy by itself, 18-20%. And what happens in China has to have a big impact elsewhere, and it's about to have that impact. At the same time, the U.S. economy is not growing very, very well, still stuck in this sub 2% annual growth rate, with prices beginning to fall, or slow, rather. And the stock market, an imminent major correction of 10 to 20% on the horizon in the U.S. stock market. We'll see whether the U.S. Has its fifth relapse in the real economy here in the first half of this year, as it has in every of the four past years in the winter term. And then Europe, of course, is barely growing. Germany very clearly is now slowing down, and that's the engine of Europe. Japan's been a basket case for some time, in and out of recession, even though they doctored the numbers here recently, I believe, to show that they weren't in recession when they actually were for the fifth time since 2008. So the picture is global slowdown. We have a global trade slowdown, almost a global recession. Maybe there is. We have definitely an industrial production manufacturing global recession underway. Only thing holding everything up is services. And those numbers are not all reliable, I don't think. And we are slowly, the global economy is slowly grinding to a halt here in many ways. And we're seeing it now erupt in forms of financial instability everywhere. To understand this relationship between financial markets and real markets, you have to understand financial cycles, real cycles. And mainstream economics does not explain this very well.
The greedy